This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Mike Waldridge, and I'm talking to Australian peace activist Donna Mulhern about her decision to go to Iraq as a human shield to try to prevent the West from going to war with Saddam Hussein. It didn't succeed, but does she still think she did the right thing?
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Roger Hearing, and on this edition, we'll hear from a biotech boss who isn't worried that vaccine orders will drop if Donald Trump's anti-vax ally becomes the new US Health Secretary. Also, the enormous task facing Sri Lanka's new president, helping his poverty-struck people while also keeping in with the IMF. And the perils for a Chinese company of gold mining in Colombia.
No one would have ever thought you would have combat 600, 700 yards underground and that you'd be losing against a bunch of illegal miners.
We'll hear all about that. You can contact us on WhatsApp or send us a voice note. +44 330 678 3033 is the number to get us. That's +44 330 678 3033. Now, the news that Donald Trump wants Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to be his health secretary when he takes over as US president in January has caused some concern because Mr. Kennedy is a leading vaccine skeptic. The senior Trump advisor, Corey Lewandowski, says Kennedy's unorthodox views may be an advantage.
Diabetes now is up 80% in the last decade. We have more childhood obesity than we have ever had. And we don't have a healthy country. So if the goal of the Department of Health and Human Services is to make sure that the American population is as healthy as possible, then I think the outside-the-box thinking that RFK Jr. brings to that is something that we should embrace and see what occurs should he be confirmed by the U.S. Senate, which I believe he will be.
Corey Lewandowski. But the head of a leading American health foundation said the appointment would pose incredible risks to the health of the nation. And what he might do if confirmed as health secretary has been reflected in what's happened to biotech shares today. Shares in global vaccine makers fell sharply, including AstraZeneca, GSK and Sanofi. But one leading biotech is sounding rather bullish. The Danish firm Bavarian Nordic, as I heard from their CEO, Paul Chaplin.
First of all, we just have to wait and see what will happen. However, when I look back at the first term for Trump, it was very successful for us in terms of the public preparedness business and the biodefense. So I still anticipate, actually, that that will be the case under the new administration coming in next year. The concern, I guess, amongst investors is the vaccine skepticism, but a lot of that was still around in the first term. So personally, I think for parts of our business, I think it will be good. And for other parts of the business, it's too early to say, and we have to wait and see how things develop.
Well, you say, obviously, in his first term, it was good for your industry, but that was obviously the time of COVID at the end of his first term. So I suppose you'd expect your industry to do well from that. But you have now got someone in there who has very strong policies on a number of issues, but particularly in terms of vaccine scepticism. Are you suggesting that isn't going to translate into policy?
It might, but as I said, I think we have to wait and see how it really evolves. When I said the first term was good for us, part of our business is our Mpox and smallpox vaccine, and the biodefense program in the US went from strength to strength under Trump, and I still believe that will be the case in this term. What will happen to the general vaccine business? I still think vaccines are an important part for public health, and skepticism aside, that's always existed, I think will still be an important component of the public health policy in the US.
So what's happening at the moment in terms of a lot of companies, rivals to you, I guess, AstraZeneca and co, their share price dropping? You think that that's a misreading of the situation?
Well, I just think it's too early to say what will happen. Whenever there's risk, whenever there's uncertainty, it's impacted in the share price. So I, like all other CEOs, have to deal with fact, and we'll have to see how the situation develops. Vaccines have changed the public health around the globe. And I don't think that situation is going to change. Vaccines are an important component of all health policies. And I still believe that will be the case in the US administration.
But CEOs like yourself, as you say, you have to deal with facts, but you also have to deal with expectations in terms of planning for your company. A lot of what you deal with is quite long term, but you're certainly not building in then any kind of idea that there will be a downturn in terms of demand from the US.
Well, this is all very new, right? The announcement of the appointment was yesterday. We work with various different scenarios all the time. We haven't specifically worked on a scenario where there is a downturn in the acceptability of vaccines, but we'll have to see. I think we have to deal with facts, and let's see what happens in the coming weeks and months.
Paul Chaplin there, CEO of Bavarian Nordic. Well, let's hear about what's been happening with the vaccine company's share prices. I'm joined now by Shanti Kellerman, Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Shanti, thanks for being with us again. How has it been for AstraZeneca, for example?
So a lot of these companies have seen their share prices fall over the past month, with the majority of that coming after Trump was reelected. So AstraZeneca, for example, down 15% in the past month. Moderna, one of the COVID vaccine makers well known, is down about 35%. So certainly having a bit of weakness there in response to just a less certain business environment and not knowing what demand will be.
And I suppose specifically for companies like Sanofi and GSK as well, the feeling that there might be someone in the administration who doesn't really want what they produce.
Yeah, that's possible. And I think if he is confirmed by the Senate and gets in, once we know the policies, you might see people go back into some of these or evaluate how they go. But, you know, the worst thing from an investor's perspective is just not knowing what will happen. And you'll always want to have some sort of assurance about the business plan, the numbers, what sort of profits they'll be able to deliver.
I was just going to say, and let's move away perhaps then from biotech to other companies and what they're up to. We've had some interesting times, I think, from Alibaba. Now, this is a Chinese company, very important in the Chinese economy and elsewhere as well. But actually, in terms of earnings, not looking good at the moment.
No, and that reflects that the wider Chinese economy and consumers aren't in a great place right now. So Alibaba, spans, it has IT segments, it has retail sales. Some of their business divisions and their things like their cloud and software sales were a bit better. That offset some of the weaker consumer spending they had. But they've also been through this 3-year plan to try to divest and get out of different areas. The government had accused them of having monopolistic activities. So trying to put a lot of that behind them, which has soaked up a lot of time recently.
And briefly, Shanti, interesting thing came up with Land Securities, massive owner of properties, of office properties, really, particularly in the UK. And they're reporting a renewed profit. In the past, there's been all sorts of gloom about office space not being needed because of working from home. That seems to be turning around.
It's turning a little. So they had the first time in 2 years they've upgraded the value of their assets, although the upgrade was only about 1%, so nothing to get too excited about. And that reflects we've seen real estate rebound a bit across the globe this year as interest rates have stabilized a bit more.
Interesting times, and see what happens with all that working from home and how it affects it. Shanti, thanks so much for being with us. Shanti Kellerman there. Now, China's President Xi Jinping is in South America at the moment. He was at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group, APEC, which has just finished its summit in Peru. And next week, he's going to be in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil for the G20 meeting. He's taking the opportunity to meet regional leaders in an area where China's been increasing its investment in recent years. But these ventures don't always go well. Zijin Mining Group, a state-owned company, has control of Colombia's richest gold mine, although, in fact, they don't really control it, as illegal miners with guns backed by drug cartels are turning the whole enterprise into a major headache for the Chinese, as I heard from the Wall Street Journal's South America bureau chief, Juan Ferrero.
This is the largest underground gold mine in Colombia, and it has about 90 kilometers of tunnels. The problem for the Chinese has been that hundreds of illegal miners have burrowed their way into the tunnels of the mine. The mine is, by the way, Zijin. So these illegal miners are in the tunnels and they're advancing. They're advancing with the help of a narco trafficking militia in Colombia called the Gulf Clan, which has thousands of members and mostly focuses its efforts on trafficking cocaine to the U.S. and to Europe. But they're also involved in gold mining.
So how is this causing problems for the company? What's happening? How are they dealing with it?
Well, the company has been unable to deal with it very effectively. This mine is on a mountain. The illegal miners have burrowed in through passageways. They are armed. There are Gulf Clan militia members. They're armed with, you know, assault rifles and explosives and so forth. And they push Zijin back. Zijin uses armed guards, and these guys have shotguns and so forth, and they use sandbags to protect as much of the mine as they can, but they generally get pushed back. Zijin says some 60% or so of its tunnels are now under control by these illegal miners and the militia, the Gulf Clan.
So they've lost a lot of gold, I guess.
Well, last year, there was more than 8 tons pulled out of that mine, and most of it was in the hands of Zijin, but 3.2 tons were in the hands of illegal miners. That's worth more than $200 million.
So can the company not get the local authorities to deal with this? I mean, if it's an issue of armed men, surely the police, the army can be involved?
Look, the police and the army are there. They are deployed to the area, but there really isn't much in the way of heavy contact with the militia members. Part of this is politics. Colombia has a left-wing government of Gustavo Petro. First of all, this government is very much anti-big mining, but they also have a different perspective on how to deal with this. They do not want to engage because of the fear of people getting killed. And what they propose is to transform Colombia's economy to provide more jobs for people like those miners. Of course, that kind of an effort could take years, maybe even decades.
So what about Zijin? Do they tell you what they're trying to do? Are they going to try and seize this back, or are they just going to let it happen?
Well, Zijin has filed suit against the Colombian government, which has really irritated Colombian officials. And they do have their guards there. So they are hoping to contain and try to keep the lower part of the mine, which happens to also be the richest part of the mine with the most gold. So they're trying to see if they can keep that part of the mine and continue to produce as much gold as they can. Right now, the illegal miners have 2/3 of the mine. They have the very top, and then they have sort of the middle section. The bottom section, the deepest section, is still in the hands of Zijin.
Have there been clashes between the guards and the illegal miners? I mean, have they exchanged fire?
Oh, yes, that's happened. Last year, a couple of guards were killed, and there have been cases of miners being killed, mainly, though, from, you know, rock slides, electrocutions, you know, things of that nature, because this is very much, you know, mining conducted without any kind of controls or any kind of quality control or anything like that. So it's very dangerous.
Now, Juan, I mean, you obviously know that China is has invested quite a lot in South America. Indeed, some of the key meetings at APEC, G20 reflect that involvement. And President Xi, of course, is in South America at the moment. But are there doubts growing in Chinese business about the wisdom of investing in this kind of thing?
You know, that's hard to say because, you know, Chinese officials are very tight-lipped about those kinds of things. What was interesting to me is that in this case, the Chinese were so exasperated that the CEO did talk to me a lot about the problems that the mine is having and that Zijin is having in Colombia and their efforts to try to get the Colombian government to do more. But, you know, in terms of top officials, it's hard to say. Having said that, I mean, this is a Chinese-controlled mine. So, in other words, the state is behind this all the way. If this CEO talked to me, then this is the way the Chinese government thinks about this issue in Colombia. Now, the Chinese across Latin America and really across the world are incredibly patient. They are doing business in countries that have all kinds of problems. I think that the interesting thing here is no one would have ever thought you would have combat underground, 600, 700 yards underground, and that you'd be losing something like this against a bunch of illegal miners.
Juan Ferrero speaking to me.
Witness the stories that have shaped our world.
On the launch pad, in the dawn light, a towering symbol of an ambitious nation.
3, 2, 1.
The whole of India was watching.
Told by the people who were there.
I still don't regret that I was part of Rose Revolution. I was a witness of very exciting days.
Witness history. From the BBC World Service. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, the EU has a plan to stop goods such as beef and soy coming in that are linked to deforestation, which is one of the key problems in climate change. Or at least they did have a plan. The EU Deforestation Regulation, or EUDR, has now been kicked into the long grass, delayed by a year, in fact, after complaints from a group of 20 EU countries, some companies, and non-EU countries such as Brazil, Indonesia, and the United States. Well, what might surprise you is that not all companies caught up in this are happy about the delay. Well, I'm joined by my colleague, Leanna Byrne. Leanna, thanks for being with us. I gather some companies actually don't want this delay.
Yeah, it's kind of surprising, actually, Roger, because you would think big companies would be happy with delay on any regulation. But yes, a number of companies like Nestle, Mars and Ferrero, they say they're supportive of the legislation. And I spoke to Francesco Tramontan. He is vice president of global public affairs at Ferrero. He said they are completely ready to be compliant with it. So here's what he had to say.
At Ferrero, we are supportive of the UDR and legislation, as it builds on a long-standing investment in traceability and strategic risk management with our suppliers. So we've been supportive all through the legislation process. So what happened now, some of the new amendments, we actually revised the substance of the legislation, is not something that we are welcoming. The delay in itself, you know, there was a proposed delay or 12 months. That is okay in light of some administrative delays. So I think that's not an issue in itself. What really worried us more is the reopening of some of the substance of the legislation.
So it's very interesting what he's saying there, Leah. He seems to be in almost a middle position. I mean, the company essentially doesn't want anything new to be added to the legislation.
Yeah, that is exactly it. So Tramontan said the delay alone is not the problem. Ferrero was prepared to meet the original timeline. In fact, we just heard him say there that this 12-month delay, it's totally acceptable. They are ready to accept that. It's those added amendments like this zero risk category for countries that raises concerns with him. And that's essentially where the EU is going to label some countries as low risk for deforestation, which means imports from these areas could face fewer checks. But this move worries companies like Ferrero. Tramontan called this a whole new set of uncertainties. He says it adds confusion, it adds loopholes. And he just doesn't welcome it. The thing is, for the exporting countries who lobbied for these changes in the ban, they've been saying that the regulation is punitive, it's discriminatory. So I put to him that maybe looser rules might actually help these suppliers, which means it'll help with the costs.
In that sense, all was needed was the proposed delay that would have given more time to comply. For the rest, as I was saying, our supply chain is already traceable and with the right due diligence. So there's clearly an inherent cost, but there's nothing that is material to the consumers in that sense.
Francesco Tramontan there, Vice President of Global Public Affairs at Ferrero, speaking to our very own Leanna Byrne. And I should add, we did ask the European Commission for their thoughts on this, and they gave us quite a long statement. I'll give you a couple of bits. Given the EUDR's novel character, the swift calendar, and the variety of international stakeholders involved, the Commission considers a 12-month additional time to phase in the system is a balanced solution to support operators around the world in securing a smooth implementation from the start. And they also said the extension proposal in no way puts into question the objectives or the substance of the law as agreed by EU co-legislators. That's the view of the European Commission. Now, Sri Lanka's new president, Anura Kumara Dissanayake, has secured a parliamentary majority for his left-wing National People's Power after calling snap elections. The result is a boost for Mr. Dissanayake, who was elected president in September on a promise to combat corruption. A clear mandate will help him consolidate power and advance his policies in the island nation struggling to emerge from a severe financial crisis. These people in the capital, Colombo, said they were hopeful the new government would help those most in need.
We expect President Anura Kumara Dissanayake to do justice for the poor people.
We have given this government a two-thirds majority. What we say is, give people concessions.
So what can or should the new president do to improve an economy that's been in debt crisis since 2022? Dr. Ahilan Kadegama is a senior lecturer in political economy at the University of Jaffna.
His first priority has been to provide relief to the people. It's been a number of years now since Sri Lanka has been in this severe economic crisis. 2.5 years ago, there were major protests in Sri Lanka where even the president was chased out of the country. So that should be foremost in his mind and figure out a way to provide relief to the people. However, Sri Lanka is in an IMF program with strict austerity measures. So where he's going to be able to find the funds to provide that relief is going to be a major concern.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a very difficult call for him because, as you say, there are this IMF program, which is very important, but it doesn't mean he can spend big, does it?
That's right, because the IMF has certain targets, in particular a 2.3% primary budget surplus, which means from a huge deficit, we've been asked to move to a surplus, so which involves higher taxes and lower state expenditure. So unless he finds a way to negotiate with the IMF, possibly even a new debt sustainability analysis, it's going to be very difficult to provide that relief. And the economy itself hasn't really been growing. And in fact, I would say the economy is in a deflationary spiral right now from the very high inflation that we saw. Now inflation is in the negative realm. So all of this are big challenges for the president. And it's probably going to be the sort of the make or break question for him in the years ahead.
Why has Sri Lanka got into this terrible mess there? Because it's a very fertile place. It has a lot of tourism. It produces quite a lot in food terms. Why is it the economy in such a bad place?
A lot of it started when there was the global financial crisis in the West, and there was a lot of supply-side push of credit into Sri Lanka. And it's not just Sri Lanka. I think Ghana, Zambia, so many countries started borrowing in the international capital markets around the same time, the late 2000s. And now, 15 years later, all these countries have defaulted on their debt, and they owe a huge amount of money to these international bondholders. And these were loans at very high interest rates. And now trying to repay that has been a huge headache for them.
Is there any chance, potentially, of more disorder, I suppose, if people continue to feel the austerity that they are put into? Because that was what drove, of course, a lot of the trouble before.
That's right. In fact, this whole call for system change in Sri Lanka started with the economic crisis and the shortage of supplies and so on. So despite Sri Lanka being in this IMF program, the next external shock, if there was a huge rise in global oil prices, for example, it could very well push Sri Lanka back into a crisis. So that is what he needs to prepare for. And poverty has doubled, malnutrition is on the rise. So he needs to look at those questions and ensure we have a much stronger food system, which also means focusing on agriculture.
Dr. Ahilan Kadegama of the University of Jaffna in Sri Lanka. Now, in one of the biggest ever crypto coin fraud cases, a New York technology entrepreneur has been sentenced to 5 years in prison. Ilya Liechtenstein admitted hacking into the gigantic crypto exchange, Bitfinex, in 2016, using advanced hacking tools and techniques, and stealing about 120,000 Bitcoin. His wife, Heather Morgan, admitted to laundering the money, partly through her hip-hop music videos, in which her alias was Razzle Khan.
Minutes to society, higher than the sky can see. You can't get as high as me. Synesthesia, I can see. Minutes to society.
Well, now you might say she's having to face the music, I suppose. Let's talk about all this with Michel Fleury, our New York business correspondent. Michel, first of all, just explain what it was that these two did.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time of their arrest, there was so much focus on Razzle Khan, Heather Morgan, the wife of Ilya Liechtenstein, because of her alias as a sort of hip-hop music star wannabe. But look, at the time, if you go back, it was called the biggest crypto heist in history. And police raided their Manhattan apartment and they found hollowed out books in his office where phones were concealed. There were dozens of USBs, wads of cash lying around. But crucially, they also found a spreadsheet that meticulously detailed how they laundered the money, the stash that was worth about $4.5 billion at the time of the arrest. And this is a case that goes back to 2016, when an unknown hacker, who we now know was Liechtenstein, moved about $120,000 worth of bitcoins out of the crypto company Bitfinex to their own digital wallet. That stash was viewable on the internet to everyone, but it was untouchable because only one person held the digital key. A year later, Liechtenstein and Morgan began trying to launder the Bitcoin into traditional money, and they sort of tried every trick in the book to hide their tracks, sending small sums of Bitcoin to thousands of different crypto wallets owned by fake identities, mixing it through criminal darknet marketplaces. They set up shell companies to try and make the funds look legitimate. And police followed this for years, but one of the key mistakes, really, that sort of ultimately led to their arrest was buying supermarket vouchers with the stolen funds, and police were able to kind of track it.
Gosh, it's a hugely involved thing. But I suppose that the lesson from all this seems to be, Michelle, you and I have spoken on many occasions about different hacking events involving Bitcoin and Bitcoin and crypto exchanges like this. There seems to be a real hole in the system that this kind of thing can go on like this.
Well, I think originally there was a hole in the system, but I think if anything, what we've seen from this is that the authorities have become better at sort of tracing the path, that the idea that Bitcoin was this kind of big black hole, or cryptocurrencies were a big black hole where anything could happen, and authorities have been able to actually trace and follow through kind of the origins of this money. So in this particular case, you have Liechtenstein and Morgan, who were unable to hide, despite sort of very kind of meticulous attempts. They were unable to kind of break that chain between who owned the Bitcoin and kind of how that ultimately led back to traditional money. And I think that's the development, really, that is key, I guess, that we should take away from this.
And very briefly, of course, with Bitcoin now, I think, well, it was about over $80,000. It matters far more, I suppose, perhaps, than it did.
Well, I mean, if you look at the US election, Donald Trump promised to sort of make crypto a kind of more to make America the capital of crypto.
Yeah. So
you start to see it moving more and more into political circles and financial circles and kind of gaining legitimacy in a way that perhaps historically it hasn't always had.
Really interesting. Thank you so much for being with us. Michelle Fleury there, our New York business correspondent, on that extraordinary crypto hacking story. That's it from World Business Report. Thanks for being with us.
When we left, there was this wonderful feeling, but it was only the beginning of a nightmare.
This is a story that started with a job advert. A yacht owner looking for a crew to sail his recently renovated boat from Brazil to Europe.
For me, it was going to be a great adventure and an opportunity to gain a lot of experience.
But when police raided the vessel and discovered drugs...
cocaine, hidden under one of the beds.
It can't be!
A key suspect was miles away.
Everything revolved around him.
Who's the boss? A British guy. Fox.
Fox.
This is World of Secrets from the BBC World Service. Season 5, Finding Mr. Fox. Search for World of Secrets wherever you get your BBC podcasts.